Hello and welcome to the Building Better Leaders podcast, brought to you by Scaffold Coaching. I'm Rachel Sullivan.
And I'm John Tattersall.
Hello and welcome to the Building Better Leaders podcast. We are on episode number 51 and Rachel and I are absolutely delighted to be chatting today with Geert Jan Hofsted. Geert is a speaker and trainer around cross-cultural issues, evolution of culture, organisational behaviour, trust and transparency. We kick off this interview with Geert really trying to educate me as to how to introduce his name correctly. If you're interested in how culture affects your organisation, the work that you do in your organisation, then you're going to absolutely love this podcast. Once again, as with all our guests, we're really, really grateful for the amount of time that they put aside to chatting to us in the podcast. So, over to Geert Jan Hofsted.
So, it's not Geert like burp, but it's Geert like red.
Geert Jan.
Yes, and you have a tendency to create a H of it, Geert Jan, that's okay. Okay, it's sort of close to the G sound.
Right, yeah, we just don't seem to have that. Or I don't anyway.
And to make it difficult, my dad was Geert with a long E.
Ah, so that's the double
yeah.
E. Yeah, right, okay. Well, I thought how we'd start this, Geert, is to for me to basically say where I had actually come across you. And that, of course, was when I came across this wonderful book, Cultures and Organization. And it's over 10 years ago since I picked this book up. And it isn't really, I don't know how I managed to get towards this book, but it was one of those like serendipitous ways of learning. I'd read somewhere about you and your father, and so I managed to, I've obviously got the book. And I think for Rachel and I, obviously we're coaches, and so we are interested in people, and the collective of people tends to work towards cultures. And so I really found this like very useful in terms of trying to understand cultures across the world, because what we're trying to do when we go into an organization is understand them within the organization. And so I was absolutely fascinated by these six dimensions that managed somehow, even though they don't really exist, managed somehow to put some sort of framework, if you like, around this thing called culture. So I guess the place to start really is, you've mentioned your dad, Geert. What is it that got you into this this particular field of work?
Right, yeah, well, good question. Because obviously, as a Dutch boy, the last thing in the world I wanted to do when I grew up, I was the first, the eldest in the family, was to repeat what my dad was doing. I mean, he was suppressing workers. He was asking questions of people in organizations so that the managers might be better able to suppress the workers. I mean, that was sort of the idea that was running around at the time in the 60s. So I was interested in living creatures and not in making money. So I was always up trees and looking at animals, busy in forests and always out of doors. So then I became a population and behavior biologist, and I had a good time studying in Wageningen University. But at the end of that, it was the mid 80s and oil crisis in the Netherlands. You may remember there were no jobs. Mm. There were no jobs at all. Instead, with a teacher's qualification, I started to be a computer programmer because that was what you could do. You could actually start learning BASIC at home. And I applied for a job. I was clever enough, and that was basically the only thing they selected you on at the time. So I was hired as an apprentice programmer. Did that. Did not like how the bosses treated me. That was far worse than my dad. So very soon I found myself in university as a teacher of computer science, which I didn't know so much about, but who else knew anything about it anyway? So I developed my own lore on databases, and I did that. But I still had this luggage of the population biologist and the behavior biologist. Mm. So to make a long story very short, when agent-based modeling came along as a technique with which you let individuals run around in your simulated world and they create some kind of a population level pattern, I was at home. And I knew this kind of stuff. And in between, I had already had my 15 years of simulation gaming experience. And during all those games in which I was observing what happened, it became apparent to me that we were very similar to the pigs that I'd been observing during my studies. I mean, we're mammals. We're eusocial mammals, actually. It is a taboo. If you go to Wikipedia, eusocial is used for animals and not for humans, for reasons that I also understand, because I've studied all these social scientists. And we humans, like other social creatures, are desperate to give our own group the highest status worthiness. Our own group is the best. If we don't believe that, we will try to change our group until we are in a group that that is the best. So we cannot live with ill esteem for our own group. So anyway, you can see that the amalgamation of computer science, biology, and my natural inclination made me very able to see what Geert was discovering. And he started doing that when I was in high school. J'étais au Collège de l'Élysée à Lausanne, en Suisse. I was in Switzerland speaking French in school there. And so I had to learn to find my way in a different civilization, not just the language. I had already had to do that when I was 7, when we moved from the east of the country to the west. You will appreciate if you move from, I don't know, Northumberland to London or to Manchester, you have some changes. And so this is similar in the Netherlands. We have all this old civilization, regional differences. So when I was 7 and again when I was 13, I had major changes in the culture around me that forced me to adapt. So all this had made me quite, if I can say so of myself, quite good at recognizing the unwritten rules of the game that was being played outside of, around of me. And this is also the quip for culture that I came up with. So my dad had coined the software of the mind, and I came up with the unwritten rules of the game. And it's sort of similar, but different levels of analysis ways to look at culture. So I was sort of, I was prepared for being aware of culture. And then when in school in Switzerland, things started to happen, I could already make some sense of it. When I came to Switzerland, it was very competitive, which had never been the case in the Netherlands. So the best student in all kinds of subjects got an award, which we would never do in the Netherlands. If we gave awards, it would be either for the last, the worst, or for the average or something, or make a joke of it. But giving awards is too much of a status award to an individual that then stands out, starts to be vain. Others will be jealous. It's not in the Dutch culture, but it is, of course, in the British and certainly also in the Swiss culture. And I got the award for my chess paper on the Gambit de la Dame, the Dame Gambit. I don't know how you call it in English. Anyway, and then there were strikes at school because one of the students who had won the poetry award in the Cathedrale de Lausanne started to denounce the hierarchical school system. Switzerland has a performance society, but very, very egalitarian, more so than England. So there are always people who do not like the hierarchy. And he started to denounce that from the pulpit in the Cathedrale. The sound was cut on him, but he kept doing it. And this was a big scandal. And there were strikes at school, which is also a bit the age of strikes. But then the director of the school came out with a whip, brandishing a whip. The cream of our society has now become whipped cream, was what the newspapers said. So I had all those adventures, and it was much more fierce than I'd ever experienced in the Netherlands. There was a big difference between being a boy or being a girl, which was not the case in the Netherlands. And all these things gave me firsthand knowledge. I was still determined not to go and study what my dad had done, but I was sort of doomed to be sensitive to it. And then when I did those simulation games in the 90s, it became clear that I'd actually found a very good way to teach cultural differences. Because in the games, people would reproduce not the synthetic hypothetical cultures that I gave them, no, their own real culture. And so there was a mix between the script I gave them and their real culture. And I became better at debriefing that.
So do you feel like it was a real destiny then in many respects, even though you didn't want to do what your dad was doing? All these things coming together, and they were just sort of moving you along this line where you were going to work in this sort of thing.
Yeah, I'm also a lot like my mother, I should say. She has never stood in the limelight, but she is very perceptive. She prefers sitting and watching or reading to taking action and changing the world. My father is more a world changer. For instance, when he was a student, he boarded on a merchant ship, sailed to England, hitchhiked his way to Edinburgh, and made some deals with companies there for his fellow electrical engineering students to come and visit. And he organized a visit of the students. This is the kind of thing that he did. I mean, he was very much driven. And I am more like my mother in my preference to not force things, but look at things and study them. But yes, you could say, if you like that word, that it was destiny. I think it's too big a word, but certainly I share some of the inclinations of my parents. And when I had obtained my PhD, it became clear to me that actually I had done that to make my dad proud, which before that time I would never have admitted to.
Isn't that interesting though, because you talk about culture and you write about culture, but we're all susceptible to it, aren't we? You know, you could have wanted to be something different, but the cultural forces of how
not just culture. So this is actually more generic, Rachel, than culture. So all human beings have the inborn design to be good, to be status worthy. I use the word status worthy. It's jargon, but it's respectable, good, valued, and so on, whatever you want to call it. They all also, if they feel wronged, have a tendency to use violence or disparaging those that did it to them. So that status power logic is in everybody. And we have groups in our minds that we refer to, reference groups. Could be our parents, could be God, could be the Beatles, could be the inhabitants of Scarabray. So, and that's the same for all humans, but the small differences in the topology of that reference group situation and in the acceptability of certain techniques, like power techniques or not, to achieve what we want, and now we're on the topic of leadership already, that differs between different societies and parts of society. So that's where you get culture. So culture is like the ripples on the ocean of this shared human nature of status power logic in reference groups. And that shared human nature is just as general as having 10 fingers. It's not a joke. It's not something that some obscure social scientists have invented. This is how we are. This is our sociality.
Yeah. Isn't it fascinating, though, how people think we can change that? And it is a shared human nature.
Yeah, well, you can change a little bit of things, of course. And I could, for instance, learn to play the piano. I will still have 10 fingers, but they can do new things. So with my same status power logic in reference groups, by, for instance, adopting more virtuous reference groups, such as, let me say, the United Nations or European Union, we could actually achieve things that we cannot do without adopting those reference groups as important for us. You don't have to change your body, you just have to train it. You don't have to change your sociality, you have to train it. And the main training of sociality occurs in infants, in the early formative years. If you have parents who are hypocrites, do not practice what they preach, and that is what your main reference group has told you is a way to get ahead in life, and it will be difficult to do something else. Perhaps you will become very, very angry at your parents and oppose them very violently, only to see later that you're using the same techniques that they have used on you. So it is true that it's very tricky. If you study culture, you are studying something of which you are an integral part.
What do you think's changed so much in the last 2 years then, Hert? In terms of, we've had a pandemic, it wasn't as, whilst a lot of people have been affected by it and lots of people have died, it wasn't anywhere near the impact that a medieval pandemic would have had. What do you think has changed in terms of leadership now in this world that we live in as a result of that?
I would say that I hope that quite a few people have had a wake-up call and have seen that if people have it too good, they have a tendency to look inwards at their own social quibbles about status and power and reference groups, instead of outwards at the world. It used to be the case in the times of Scarabre or of the Orkney inhabitants 4,000 years ago, that was certainly the case, that natural hazards were obviously the biggest hazards to humankind. That has changed. People have started to become fat cats and think that they are lords of the universe with all their rockets going to Mars. And hopefully, but I'm not very optimistic here, some leaders have learned something. Actually, I have a question for you. Why don't you call your blog Building Better Borises?
Building Better Borises.
You see, well, the leader of your country is now called Boris.
Yeah.
I know.
Yeah. Boris has this motto, Angela May, Boris might, and might is right. Right?
As political as we'd really like to be, Hert, it's probably better that we don't go down that road, but I love the idea of it.
I wonder when you were just saying about how you brought up, how hypocritical Boris's parents possibly were. There's definitely some saying one thing and doing another going on.
I mean, if you've learned that this is actually perfectly allowable, that the end justifies the means, then this is what you will do.
Yeah.
But I don't want to go Boris bashing. Let's be more serious. You could have also called your blog Building Better Citizens or Better Britons. But so why is it called Building Better Leaders instead of Building Better Citizens?
Well, I would have to offer, I'll let Rachel give you her opinion. I would have to offer that we never thought of calling it Building Better Citizens because we're generally coaching leaders in the workplace. So I would have to say, I have to go away and reflect on that because we never thought of it. What about you, Rach?
Well, when we came, like the whole concept of calling our companies called Scaffold Coaching and the tagline was Building Better Leaders. Mm. And it came out of really a purpose of, you can't be what you can't see. And actually I'd had some really amazing leaders and I'd had some really bad leaders. And the really bad leaders had had a massively detrimental impact on my life and my mental well-being. And I'd had some really bad experiences to the point that I never wanted anybody to go through that again. And I hadn't had access as a leader in the corporate world to leadership training until one of my last jobs. And when I did that job, I just thought, do you know what, if everybody got access to this, then if you had better leaders, you would have better citizens, and you would have better teams, and you would have better people. And so I kind of stepped into that space, and this was before I met John, of really driven by that, you know, if you have a good leader, it doesn't just affect your life, it affects your partner's life, your parents' life, your friends' life, you know. And and I think if we focused on the leaders, we would get better citizenship. But also it's, you know, our sphere of influence and what we can change. I have no aspirations to go into politics. So I didn't, to John's point, we didn't think as far and wide as citizenship. It came more out of a personal experience of having very good leaders and having very bad leaders.
It's interesting that really, though, Rich, because I think if all three of us are quite representative of most people, then all three of us have worked for some good leaders, but we've worked for some very bad ones. And it's the ones that you didn't get on with, the ones that you had the bad experiences from, that make you feel like you want to help other people so that they don't have to go through that. And we've all three of us have been in that position. So I tend to think that probably most people will end up working for some good, some bad. How can we, on what we do, make it actually better?
Yeah. Or being some good, some bad leader.
Yeah.
I will reveal my cards to you. Thank you for these good and honest answers. The thing is, I like what you said, John, about it never occurred to me to come up with the Building Better Citizens. And Rachel, you said that in the circle between being a leader and a citizen, being leader, better leaders build better citizens. Actually, it's of course both ways.
Yes.
Build better citizens, also build better leaders. Better citizens will be able to correct or oust leaders who are not good. And this is actually biologically something in which humans are special. No individual is strong enough to coerce everybody. So human leaders have to be political. They have to have a degree of niceness. Whether they really are so nice and give status, or whether they secretly use power by lying, for instance, and deceiving, that is another matter. But they have to have some niceness. How much and what they can do differs greatly across societies. You will have different leaders in England than one would have in Russia or China or the Netherlands or Germany, for that matter. So there is actually a sort of circularity, because both the leaders and the others are in the same sea of culture, so to speak. And therefore, there is always a codependence between leaders and followers who make one another what they are, enable or disable one another. In England, a leader is a cultural hero. That means nobody would go to or listen to a podcast called Building Better Citizens. It is much better to call your podcast Building Better Leaders if you want people to attend. I think in the Netherlands, it is different. So to give a brief saying, in the Netherlands, the leader works for the people. In England, the people work for the leader. So you have to have a charismatic, visionary leader who inspires you. In the Netherlands, the leader has to be a Democrat who doesn't stand in the way of the workers. I'm exaggerating, of course, but so already in the name of the concept of leader and in the name of the podcast, you see there is a lot of culture. And this is why it's so difficult to talk about culture. The word leader, we got the same word, leider, but we don't use it so much as the English do. And so there is a lot of cultural undertone in language and in the way you talk about things. That does not mean that I believe that leaders are not important. And also, they are important in cultures where they are important. I mean, if you believe in God, God can be very, very important to you. And so what you believe and whether something is a reference group for you is actually what matters, not whether something is true in an absolute sense, because we can disagree about that until the end of times. Whether God exists, for instance, or whether leaders are important. If everybody thinks they are important, then they are. Which also means that the two of you might actually be leaders to some people. There might be people who are desperate for your next blog to come online and who try to live up to the things that you say in those blogs. So you can be a leader without and before you know it.
Yeah, it's interesting, yeah. Really. What I particularly want to question is, politically, if you don't particularly like the way that it's going, it's what they stand for, the way that they're behaving, there almost seems to be like, well, we can't really do anything about it, so we don't, and people just sort of carry on. Whereas I would have thought that if you'd have gone back 50 years, there would have been much more opposition. There's very little opposition, I'd say, in our country in terms of one political party or the other, and an opposition. Mm-hmm. And we've talked about this before on the podcast, I think, Rachel, haven't we? Mm-hmm. Where an opposition is there to make you, as the leading party, more responsible in the decisions that you make, because you don't want to be made to look as if you're not competent. And a good opposition would do that. I don't see that so much now. Everything seems to have just sort of meshed. And if you choose one political party over the other, you're not really going to get that much difference in outcome.
But I think that's, you give your own answer. We, if I can include the citizens of the Netherlands and Britain, have it so good.
Yeah.
So we have a lot less to fight for than we did. And there are many people who don't have it so good, but they're not the majority.
No.
And voters tend to go for their own interest, especially in these individualistic countries that both of us are. So on the one hand, you have a lot of outrage against things that are going wrong at the NHS or where have you. On the other hand, most people individually, the majority, are not really suffering. So there isn't the great urgency. I think this is one factor. A second factor, and this is actually something that also emerges from research, is that the generation after a large disturbance, such as the Second World War, will be more cohesive. But the generations after that will have forgotten that feeling of collective togetherness and relief. When I was a child, I'm 65, there was this great optimism. I mean, people were waging wars in the old days. This was now all gone. Really, this was old, ancient history. And of course, today we don't have that feeling anymore. I mean, conflicts are just around the corner. I also think that the climate change is making many people very anxious, even though they repress it. They don't want to openly acknowledge it. But it could be even that part of the response to COVID is also contaminated by the basic anxiety. Oh God, the world is going down. We are being punished for our sins. But people don't want to acknowledge that openly. So it's difficult to say. It will probably be easier for people in 100 years to make sense of what is happening now. But these are two things that I believe are the case. And of course, the third one is we have a much smaller percentage of the population that are young than was the case just after the World War. I mean, everybody was young. And young people, they want to live. You know, they want to be happy and make love, not war. And old people, they can worry and fret and, oh, my grandchildren will live in a hothouse earth. What's going to happen? So.
Yes. And I think the thing with the pandemic versus the climate change thing is that the climate change is, whilst it is important that we do something about it now, it's down the road. It's not here now in the immediacy. And I think for
many... Are you serious? It is here.
It is, but
in many people's minds,
it's not. In my, you know, I can see people thinking in my lifetime, it's not going to affect me. And therefore...
Okay. Well, they won't think that in Germany or Belgium, where many people died a few months ago.
Oh, in terms of the floods. Yeah.
I certainly feel that the climate change thing, and I've got a little boy, so I do. I am in that generation where I do worry about it. But I think there's a lot of cognitive dissonance around the climate change in that I really want to do something about it, but I don't want to give up my car, or I don't want to give up. That we've become so, like you say, the individualistic culture. And what do you need to do? And, you know, I try and do things, but then you think, oh, is it enough? And it will be interesting. I wonder what the next two generations are like, because I hope they will be far closer than what we are. And like you say, you'll be able to make sense of that in 100 years' time.
Well, do you have a political party that promotes the use of electric cars and the infrastructure needed to roll them out?
No. No, there's talk on it, but no action. And there you are. And then... And there's a crisis at the minute around the electric companies, and they won't prop up the green electricity companies. And if ever there was an opportunity, that would be it. But yes, it's to your point, like it's in Europe that they're seeing the impacts of it. We haven't here yet. Although having said that, just up the road, like 5 miles from me, that was underwater 2 years ago. Like a village called Fish Lake was decimated by flooding. But it's not London.
Yes. I guess we have this saying, wie niet horen wil, moet voelen. If you don't want to hear, you will have to feel. And this is obviously true. Yeah, but it's also true that if you think you've got it too good, or you have some reason for being at all frustrated in your own dignity, you would rather go the social way than look outward. So AUKUS, for instance, fighting the Chinese. This is something that the Brits know about, and the Americans and the Australians. This is greatness. I was listening to a TV broadcast yesterday where a Dutch political thinker was being asked, do we need to fear the Chinese? And his answer was, we need to fear European indecision, which of course is made a lot more likely by Brexit. So I personally am very sad, if only for geopolitical reasons, that Brexit has happened. I think it's a rash measure, but it fits the UK culture very much.
I was going to say, let's talk about that, because I feel the same. It does feel like we're becoming more and more individual, particularly in the UK. And the Brexit has only exacerbated that. But the people that really wanted Brexit wanted things to get better. And actually, they've got worse, far worse.
But,
since
I mean,
Brexit.
You've been frankly... very gullible as a people. I mean, this was so obvious.
It was, and a lot of the Remainers would say that, but how culturally do you bring people together when I don't think ever before has there been a demonstration where one leader cannot influence everybody, but it's so neck and neck that it's just causing hatred. So there's no real majority. You know, we had this with the Conservative and Liberal Democrat coalition a few years ago. I mean, what a coalition, like, and then you have the Conservatives, Labour just haven't quite got themselves together. But it's so neck and neck that it's just dividing people.
Well, the fact is, the game in Anglo culture is it's always about winning. It's always about a match. You don't have fun if there are not two parties and you want to know which one of them is going to win. Also, the Lib Dem Conservative coalition wasn't really a coalition. As soon as the coalition was formed, Nick Clegg was gone.
Yeah,
I mean, he was very much in the public image before that time. Actually, half Dutch, so he knows what it is to do consensus. But Cameron wasn't taking any of that, and so the Lib Dems were out of the game. As far as you ask me, this is I mean, I'm not. I probably miss many things when it comes to the UK, but that was my perception.
Yeah, I think to bring it off politics and bring it back into business, though, I think that the Anglo culture we see drilling down into business as well, because we do a lot of work with businesses around their vision, mission, values, purpose. We've been trying to get them to steer towards purpose a lot more and more that infinite game. But the amount of leaders that we sit in a room today, even still 10 years on, and you say, what's your vision, what's your goal, they like to be number one, you know, it's to be the best, it's to be have the largest market share. Yes. And we're not learning. Like, that comes from, I think you can directly correlate that to the political stratosphere that is you win or you lose.
Yeah. So if you have that aim and you're willing to put a lot of pressure on those who are below you to go for that aim, whatever it takes, then you know that you will have scandals and you will have disasters. I mean, this is just waiting to happen then. If you have that aim, but you say, look, we're only going to do that by being very gentle to our workers, our clients, and everybody else, which would be the Scandinavian or the Dutch perspective, then it can also go wrong, but it's not as inevitable. If you say, we don't want to be the best, but we want to preserve our own sphere of influence, that is a more realizable goal. But these goals are sort of also inevitably brandished into us. Like I was saying, in Switzerland, you had to be the best because then you could get an award. In the Netherlands, everything is done to avoid that people, even boys, will want to be the best. This is not doing justice to the richness of the situation. Also, I know that there are quite a few very inclusive movements in England, heartwarming, so it's not all bad news. But I certainly do believe, coming back to business, that if at the bottom of things you are ready to be an asshole in order to win, that, and you are at the top of an organization, then this is disaster in the making. At the bottom of things, you have to want to be a responsible leader. And okay, you can want to win, but it has to be a game in the context of a good life.
Yeah.
And in the context of a life for your children and grandchildren. If that could be the direction of change, then like it's supposed to be in sports, you know, then winning is still good, but losing while having played a fair game is honorable too.
Yes. Yeah.
And as soon as that becomes a dishonor, then you're on the wrong track.
Yeah.
That's my conviction. But okay, it's easy to say. And I'm not a big leader. So leaders who have that can only become important if people in politics vote for them or in business co-opt them, which are different processes, but both are, of course, reinforced by culture.
It's very interesting you talk about winning. I think it's this win, it's the wanting to win too much, is that becomes the thing, the first thing. And I think you lose a lot when that's how you think. It's interesting what you were talking about in terms of how a leader would work for his people in your country, whereas it's in the reverse in ours. And we see that, you see that a lot in America, you see that here in the UK, and it then really does translate to wanting to win too much. I'm also wondering, just for the benefit of our listeners as well, Hert, whether you could quickly sort of go through those other dimensions that are in the cultures and organizations. But I mean, we'll put all the links in. I mean, there's a wonderful link for your father's documentary. I think if people are interested in this, they would really, really enjoy watching that. So we'll put all the links in, but I'm just wondering how those other dimensions are in play sort of right now.
In social science, it is a very different thing to compare individuals with one another from comparing groups or societies with one another. My father has done, and he was lucky because he got this database of over 60 countries, is take country averages of answers to very mundane questions about salary, working conditions, colleagues, bosses, and so on, that were asked of people of all the levels in the organization, not just the leaders, but everybody. And by analyzing all those answers at the level of groups, he came up with first four, because not all possible questions were in the first study, later five, later six, basic issues of social life that societies have to contend with, not individuals. So what do societies have to do? First, determine how independent is an individual. Is it primarily that you are like an atom in a crystal? You're fixed, not in England, but yes, in China. Or are you a loose atom in a gas? Yes, in England. Okay. So that's individualism versus collectivism. And of course, both have their stronger and less strong points, and cultures could deviate in companies from the average of the country. And you might also yourself have a different feeling about it. Expats will need to accommodate. They often can talk about the culture of a receiving country much more clearly than the locals. That's the first one. The second one is about not horizontal, but vertical relationships between people. Is there an intrinsic difference in status worthiness of some people in relation to others? Are some people descended from God, for instance, and others not? This is often the mythological way that it's couched. Is a leader intrinsically different from a follower? In England, yes. But you may know when the first English came to Australia and asked for the leader, the locals were very puzzled because they did not know that concept. They had no leaders. And if you go to Switzerland or Austria, you have leadership functions that can be muscular, but not hierarchically powerful at all. So that's the second one. It's about hierarchy. The third one is actually about muscle. So is it a power world where let the best man win, or is it a status world where let's sit down and talk it over? And of course, if it's a power world, that also gives more social status to men than to women, because they just have more muscle. And this is very much the Anglo, but also the Germanic culture, and not the Scandinavian or the Dutch culture. So, for instance, when the English get worked up about sit-down toilets for men in pubs, this is kind of touching the male honor, when I, as a Dutch, can see the practical use of it, because you just don't soil the toilet so much. So that's the third one, masculinity versus femininity. And femininity means more unisex, and masculinity means more fighting, which also means feminism is different in a masculine society than in a feminine society. In a masculine society, feminism means females can do the same thing that men could always do. In a feminine society, feminism means everybody can do caring jobs and performing jobs alike. It is a very subtle and not often grasped difference. Then we go to the fourth of the issues. It has to do with things we don't know, like COVID or climate change. How nervous are we going to get from them? And especially foodstuffs can make us very nervous, eating strange things. That's uncertainty avoidance. The English have a small uncertainty avoidance. They will go for many different impressions and places. Typically, uncertainty tolerant cultures, the Chinese are also like that, they travel a lot. You will find these people in many places. The uncertainty avoiding, like the Japanese, they are less likely to travel. This is actually a big difference between Japan and China. The fifth one is to do with short-term orientation, meaning the status power logic of the here and now is very important. We need to know who wins. for instance, or we need to be hospitable. We need to be really nice to our guests. Oh, I meet you, I like you, I'm going to give you a present or invite you for a meal. Long-term orientation, on the other hand, is, I'm sorry, but I have another meeting now, I'll see you next time. Or I need to save instead of kill the goat because my children will need the milk of the goat later. And the last one is about, finally, about the body. Can we be nice to our organism? Can we celebrate? If I am a man and I see a beautiful girl, can I rape her even if she doesn't want to? If I am the father of that girl, can I kill the rapist or my daughter if I want to? So this is about indulging the flesh, and the English are very indulgent. The Germans, for instance, are a lot less indulgent. So if you're less indulgent, it means you are more likely to keep to any rules and less likely to dance and celebrate and have loose music and so on. So these are the six issues of social life. And I believe that by now, this is a good 360 picture of social life. The individual versus the group, hierarchy in society, men versus women and violence, strange new things, time, long versus short, and finally, the organism. And to me, this makes sense also as a biologist. And I find it also very easy to relate this to the sociological status power theory of reference groups that I think is a very good synopsis of social science, binding the individual and group level. And also physiology. So our physiology, I am convinced, is also linked to, we have different hormone systems for nice things and for violent things, for instance. It's linked to the status power logic. So that's a short story.
Amazing.
Your father was onto something there, wasn't he?
Yeah, well, this is not all stuff that my dad has done. So I give you a synopsis, including more biology. But what he did was find the first four dimensions. And that was very, very big because he had to take unpaid leave and he had to take a leap of faith to do this. So he was really curiosity driven. He'd seen those results and seen that across countries there were tendencies. And then, he just wanted to know. So, yeah, I'm actually proud of him for that. Another thing that he did later was realize that his work was probably not perfect and link up with other researchers. First, it was Michael Bond, the Chinese Culture Connection. And then later there was Misha Minkov with his World Value Survey data. He linked up with those people and extended his model, which by that time, I had also started to be a colleague to my dad. I'd started when I was 40. So then by that time, I was free from this feeling, I don't want to do what my dad did. I mean, I had already got my own family and my own career. So that phase was gone. By the time I already knew that the four-factor model wasn't good for everything. It had some things that you could not really explain very well. And the six-dimension model, I like. I think it's, from a content point of view, it's satisfactory. I have to say that if you do new studies across countries, you are very likely to find slightly different things because every study can only find as much as was covered by that study. And also, if you think of a survey study, it's always a momentary exercise. And it necessarily is a filter that stresses some things, maybe forgets others, on a reality. So the last word about what are the dimensions of culture has not been said and should not be said. This is not about determining whose God is the proper God. This is about understanding life, and many religions can give you guidance in life. You don't have to choose as long as you have a religion that helps you be a decent human being. That's my philosophy about it.
Amazing. So we've talked a lot about your dad then, and the six dimensions are fascinating from a culture point of view, but your book, of course, is Culture and Organization. So how have you taken that work? And if somebody's listening to this that works in an organization, they're either a leader or they're working for leaders and want to be better citizens, to use your words, what can they take from that, from your book?
I would say that I have these three traits of leaders that I sent you in email, and let me talk briefly about them because I think they're important. So the first is, if you are anxious and afraid of something, you will contaminate those who look up to you. Everybody looks up to some people, or maybe to God, or maybe to somebody who wrote a book and they don't know in reality. If those heroes, who are then your leaders, or your spiritual leaders, your reference groups, I would say, if they display anxiety, then that's going to be contagious. Now, a little bit of anxiety could be good sometimes, but it's very easy to either underdo it by pretending nothing's wrong, or overdo it by becoming vindictive or something. You should be vigilant. So that's the first one. Stable, good mood, but be vigilant. The second one is to realize that your followers make you. Tony Blair was all powerful for a while, but after that time, as soon as he opened his mouth, people would say, go away. So your followers make you, and depending on the culture, they make you for a time. In England, they always make you for a time. It's 8 or 10 years, and then you should know when to retire. So, but it's not just about time, it's about everything you do. Try to be a leader who says something that your followers don't like to hear. It is very difficult. So if you have difficult messages, you have to be careful about them and season them with nice stuff. Right? And that is actually taking responsibility. Taking a responsibility is not just doing what will be applauded, but also doing what, when you, from your high vantage point of a leader, things that you can see and the others maybe can't, take them seriously and try to do something with those things to your followers. So that's the second. Modesty paired with responsibility. Very difficult for leaders in England, but it makes it all the more worthwhile and the more admirable if you actually do them. Third, and that's my turf, of course, culture aware. To know that one size does not fit all. If you are a good leader in Liverpool, it doesn't mean the same behaviors would help you in Hamburg. So if you then acquire a second dockyard in Hamburg, what you should do first is try to find people there who understand you well enough, anyone understand that situation, and really let yourself be helped. Observe things and ask to be helped. What does this mean? So take your 3 months to get to know the lie of the land. And don't think that you have to appear decisive straight away. One of the worst things leaders can do is they're in a new situation. They want to impose themselves by showing their power and throwing their weight around. You can do a lot of wrong. And in many countries in the world, nobody will tell you anything, because it's against the rules to be immodest or indiscreet. But if you then turn your back and come again, nobody has time for you anymore. So it's very easy to do the wrong thing as an English leader without ever noticing. Mm-hmm. So these are three attributes of good leadership in an international world.
Yeah, they're the leadership essentials that we ask each of our guests to give us. So thank you for doing that. That last one, the culture aware one, and I really I sort of acknowledge that example that you've given of having a dockyard in Liverpool and one in Hamburg. I think is it Chanel, Rachel, where for your first 90 days in any leadership role there, you're basically there to observe and ask questions of the people that you're working with. You're not allowed to make any decisions. You're just simply there to understand people. And I think it's a similar thing for Rachel and I when we go into an organization, is that we don't have all the answers. Lots of times people want us to have the answers for them. Yeah. But how do we have all the answers if we don't understand the culture of the organization, if we don't ask the people that work in it? So that is really, really very much aligned with our approach. Is we go and ask the questions, because people want, if they're really, really sort of included, wanting to be included in their purpose, it's about being able to say to people, this is what I think. And if you're never asked that, how are you supposed to ever contribute? You know, you're not going to really want anybody coming in through the door saying that you should do this, you should do that, you should do the other. You don't know.
Well, it depends on the culture again. I mean, there are countries in which nobody expects to pronounce themselves if they are not the leader. Mm. And if you want to give feedback to leaders, you have to be devious is not the word, indirect about it. And a leader has to do more work in order to get evidence from their people, because you can't count on them to just come forward and say so. Mm. So all these things are subject to cultural differences.
You've observed a lot of cultural studies and differences over the course of your work. Where do you think things are heading for obviously international culture, but also for the culture of work? Where do you think we'll be in 10 and 20 years time if things continue the way they are?
Well, there isn't a culture of work. I mean, a culture is what you are fed with your mother's milk, so to speak. And organizations, as soon as it starts to build a culture. When it's just new, it doesn't have one yet. But then it starts to build. And that happens through all the feedback that all the people in the organization give one another all the time. And since those people, especially the leaders, tend to be from one place in the world, that organization tends to form one of the forms of the culture of that country, of that place in the world, which is why the work of Geert Hofstede is useful also to study organizations. But leaders in organization can bring nuances. They can do things. And that's especially in the realm of how trustworthy and accountable are we to one another. This is what you could improve in an organization. But as soon as you have a certain name as the organization, then being a member of that organization is itself a commodity of status. And that starts to then create a dynamic inherited from the dynamic in this country. So people will want to work in your place and pretend they play the game, but really they're interested in showing off that they work there. So there's no separated culture from the background culture of your nation. Now, I have to say it's also true that there is kind of a set of practices that are agreed on in higher level of international companies. There's a sort of international working culture, maybe that's what you refer to, but without being integrated in the culture of the country in which you work, that is not going to take you very far. Even if there is ever more automation, you still work with people. And you still have to make them feel valued, or else you'll pay the price one day. So I do think that in the longer term, we'll see more of a capacity of people in the world to work together. It's already the case that compared to prehistory, almost nobody gets their skull smashed. Used to be almost everybody. And many of the skulls that we find that are really old, it doesn't happen so often. Instead, we tend to go for the non-violent solution, or ritualize the violence in sport or military displays, which is, of course, what happens in most animal species. There's a lot of display and not so much actual fighting. I think that a lot of continuity in the cultures of the countries of the world, posing as change, as we've seen for the last centuries. So, for instance, Chanel is a French company. The French are long-term oriented, not very masculine. They, you could imagine that they would value this 3 months of observation as a company practice. I would not so soon see that in an English company because, you know, 3 months of worth salary, where's our bottom line? So there's a lot of continuity that we don't really see because we don't live long enough. And we don't set our sights to the future, which is why I like to have this background of 4,000 years ago, you know, it, which is a very good symbol of coherence of that population. They built this together as a sort of testimony to this is what we can create as a monument of our togetherness. They weren't thinking of us when they made that. They were thinking of themselves.
Just for the purpose of our listeners that are just listening to the audio, what is your background, please?
I think if you're English, you do well to be proud of the ancient inhabitants of the Orkney Islands 4,000 years ago. They were the same generation people that also built Stonehenge in England. Mm-hmm. Actually, a lot of pig carcasses were found in Stonehenge that have a provenance of the Orkneys and other places. So those people would all have gatherings. And I bet they also went into what you English call Europe. We tend to call England Europe too, you know, and even Ireland. But you tend to not do that, continent isolated, this kind of thing. But so this is the Orkneys 4,000 years ago.
Yeah, amazing place. I'd highly recommend.
Ring of Brodgar with all these megaliths in a huge circle of 100 metres in diameter or so.
We're sort of coming towards the end of the podcast, and it's been wonderful to have you on. I've so been looking forward to this. And so thank you for so much of your contribution. If people want to get hold of you, how do they do that? And I'm just wondering what's ahead for you? What's around the corner for you now?
Okay, well, thank you very much. I had lots of fun in this hour. Time goes very fast when you're having fun. Time flies, it's the same. What's ahead for me is today I will be teaching this afternoon in Wageningen University, where they have this hugely beautiful new building, Aurora. But then I'm 65, so in 2 years I will be happily devoting even more of my time to my probably 7 grandchildren at the time. So, and I have my old mother. My dad died last year, but my mum is still there. So I really have a lot of relational issues to do. If people want to talk to me, well, they can try me. You can find Gert-Jan Hofstede easily through Google. And also there are some really nice audio and visual displays, both more academic and more popular. If you go to the site geerthofstede.com.
Yeah, excellent. We'll put a link to that and the show notes.
I think it was very brief, so I did not really say so much about the dimensions and what they mean for business life, but a lot of that is being written in all kinds of places. A lot of this is common sense. Mm-hmm. As soon as you have issues in your working life that puzzle you, or people seem to be really silly or really evil, then probably you need to understand better. And if you can, which is often very difficult if you feel stress about it or angry, take a step back and try to, fly in a little helicopter, try to look from above. What's happening here? Can I make sense of this? Who is giving too little status to somebody else? That's when you have misunderstandings. Who is using power? That's when you're trying to reach something that people are not willingly giving you. And which reference groups are playing a role here? Who's involved? And how is all this changing due to the cultures of those who are in that situation? Which is not so easy, because if they are individuals, they might not be representative of the culture of their mother countries. Although often they are more so than they would maybe know themselves. One last remark. The English hate to be put in a basket. They hate to be told that they are part of a group that is alike. But it's still true. And this is actually a common characteristic.
I think that's, that's a really true point. We always say about our young people, they're all wanting to be different, but in the same way, you know, you like look at them, they're all looking after that for their own individuality, but they all still look the same.
Yeah, but they don't have to despair. They are different. Everybody is unique.
Exactly.
Do not despair. Just live your life and try to find people who are good to you and who you can be good to, because that in the end will give you the best life. So if you're interested in that and you feel that you're left on your hunger, either take the book, which I think is the best solution, but it's time consuming, or go to geerthofstede.com.
Excellent. Absolutely wonderful having you on. Thank you so much for today.
Thank you, John. Thank you, Rachel. And it was a pleasure talking to you. And keep up the good work, I'd say.
Thank you so much for listening to the Building Better Leaders podcast. We hope you've got a lot out of this. If you'd like to read up a bit more on any of the content that you've heard in today's podcast, be sure to check out our website, scaffoldcoaching.com.